Thank you for joining this session. My name's Alan Merton. We had a comment this morning in the plenary where Siddharth said he honestly gets this question from his investors about why life insurance companies are still writing disability income insurance if it's so unprofitable. And that was well-timed for the topic of this, although we're not talking so much about profitability today. We're talking, I think, more about the relevance to customers and how we can make sure that it is a valued product. So I won't be speaking very much, which for those of you who know me is a surprise. Thank you, Andrew. Emily Gaylor and Mark Rayberger are with me, and I'll briefly just tell you a bit about them because you probably haven't seen the CVs. One of the nice things, and I'd like you to particularly welcome Mark, because he is not an actuary. He's a physiotherapist by training, and he's only recently joined the life insurance industry at AMP, but brings, I think, was 10 years of practicing as a physio, then a whole lot of time in workers' comp insurance, and now bringing those skills to AMP. And if you want the bigger CV, grab him for a coffee, and I'm sure he'll happily talk about himself. That wasn't meant to be disparaging at all. He's a lovely guy. Emily Gaylor is also with AMP and specialises in the team that looks after analysis and insights, and which is great because we've had a few conversations about looking at data, but the interesting thing is what do you do with it? And has experience in Europe as a consulting actuary and now also, as I said, with AMP. So we're going to hear from each of them today. They are happy to break with tradition, and if you've got a question or a comment on the way through, just stick your hand in, up, and we'll pause, and either they'll see it and pause or I'll see it and pause them. So feel free to go to the microphone, but you do need to go to the microphone. If not, take your notes, write your questions down, and we'll take questions at the end. So having said all that, I will hand over to Mark to kick it off.
Well, thanks, Alan, and welcome to this session. I woke up this morning and, as I usually do with my wife, we spoke about what we're going to be doing today, and I said I'm actually doing a presentation at the Actuaries Conference, and I'm going to be talking about the health benefits of work. And it was in the midst of trying to do lunches, gather stuff. My wife had to go to work. She's a GP. She was going to the clinic, and I was running around headless, and she goes, "Are there really benefits of work? I feel like I'd be better off staying home." And I'm sure some of us have all had those thoughts from time to time and feel that it isn't always the best place to be. But what we're going to talk today is just a little bit more about the details around what that looks like. And to start with, I'd like you to just consider a scenario. Imagine you've fallen sick or you've had an accident. You've gone to your doctor, you've spoken to your doctor, and you've been given a diagnosis. And the diagnosis might not necessarily be good news. And they've given you news that you're too sick to go to work. So you take some time off, maybe a couple of weeks. Eventually, a couple of weeks turns into a few months and your diagnosis becomes more sinister or more significant. You approach your insurer. They accept your claim. The insurer starts paying your claim. As time goes on, your job no longer exists. You've got nowhere to go back to. And you need to now look at what your future holds. I just want you to imagine for a minute and one word that would describe that situation if that person was you. Are there any words that come to mind?
Scary.
Scary, yep. Definitely.
Sad.
Sad, yep.
Hopeless.
So certainly I think scary, sad and hopeless would certainly be words that you'd be thinking about if you're off and not able to do what you either loved or wanted to do for a number of years. And this goes not just for work, but also your social activities, sport, doing things with your children. So often what we find is that whilst we as insurers want to pay people when they have genuine claims, sometimes people want more than that. So it's been as recent as about 2008 and possibly back to 2006. In the UK, there was a lot of research done around work and worklessness. And this research was conducted by a number of researchers, including Professor Gordon Waddell and Dame Carol Black, and I've just put up a few quotes from them as to pieces that they've found around long-term worklessness. And the news isn't great, and certainly the health risks for being off work for significant periods of time are far from positive, and we probably know that probably makes sense. Interestingly, though, worklessness has been shown to be actually more dangerous than working in some of the most dangerous occupations that we know of, including working on oil rigs in the North Sea. So as you can imagine, this period of worklessness and what it does to someone's health is critical. Furthermore, Dame Carol Black, again from the UK, stated that for most people, their work is a key determinant of self-worth, self-esteem, identity and standing within the community. Work is a means of social participation and fulfilment. We all talk about what we do, when we do it, why we do it, and what that feels like. So work is a determinant of what we are and who we are. In about 2009, 2010, Australia, and it was actually in Victoria, and it was the Victorian WorkSafe Authority, picked up on a piece of work around this health benefits of work, back then as it was called. And the Australasian Faculty of Occupational and Environmental Medicine created a position statement around the health benefits of work. And that position statement, as I said, is quite recent. And it draws on some of the learnings that we get from our UK friends and builds on that and provides a statement that the college, that faculty is trying to deliver both to the community and to the medical fraternity and also to industry and insurers to get a better understanding as to what it actually is and what good work actually looks like. So we're here to talk to you a little bit about that position statement and what we can do and what the research is showing us around those pieces. So I'm going to hand over to Emily and she'll talk through the numbers because being an actuary, I can't do numbers. So I'll leave that bit to her. Thanks.
Sorry to all of you, there aren't actually very many numbers in this presentation. Apologies as well. I seem to be losing my voice, so I'll go with being husky rather than hoarse. But I might end up having to go for my my water. So as Mark's alluded to, there is quite a bit of evidence out there that supports a link between unemployment and ill health. And in this context, when we're talking about unemployment, we're not just talking about sort of people who are looking for work who can't find work. We're also talking about people who are, say, on disability benefits or maybe people who have a disability income coming in from an insurer. So don't necessarily associate unemployment with, say, low income. It's not necessarily the same thing. And what we see from the evidence is that this unemployment or worklessness is linked generally to both physical ill health but also mental ill health. And we see it coming through at different ages as well. So most of the research that's out there is around middle-aged. That's where the focus has generally been. And that's where all of these come through really strongly. In younger people, the physical ill health doesn't come through as strongly. Potential reasons for that, younger people tend to be more resilient from a physical health point of view. But when you look at the mental health, the impacts are definitely there. And there's quite a significant increase in suicides, for example, among unemployed young people compared to employed young people. And that's obviously pretty huge. And for younger people who are unemployed, they can get into a cycle. So they become more likely to be unemployed when they're in their middle ages and these sort of ill health issues continue to unfold. As actuaries, as statisticians, we tend to look at these things and say, oh, but, you know, is it correlation or is it causation? You know, there's obviously, we all talk about demographics. We all know that there's a lot of things in there that get sort of confused, that get pulled together. Interestingly, a lot of the evidence does suggest that there is a causative factor in play here. And there's a couple of different mechanisms that have been discussed about why that might be. I don't think there's really consensus about what they are. The answer is probably that there's multiple. But some of them, for example, if you're off work, people tend to be more stressed. So stress itself can lead to mental ill health. But stress can lead to high blood pressure, which can potentially lead to physical ill health. And also, if you're not working, you may have different lifestyle choices. You may be driven down different lifestyle paths, and those too can have an impact on your physical health. So if we've talked about the adverse health outcomes of unemployment, what about the converse? Are there actual benefits that we can see from going out to work? And the answer from the research, again, is yes. So the research that's out there really does generally support the view that work is beneficial for health. So again, you know, there's a couple of things you can say around this. In today's society, work equals money, generally, for most people. Most of us aren't lucky enough to have a trust fund. So if you go to work, you get an income. That generally helps to support your lifestyle. It helps to support your hobbies, helps to support things you enjoy. Even if you have a disability income product, most of the time payout ratios are going to be under 100%. And often people will have medical bills as well, which can be quite significant. So even if they have an insurance policy, being out of work is probably going to mean some sort of impact on their lifestyle. And then for most people, work is really intrinsic to who they are. So if you imagine you've sort of probably met various people at this conference or when you're a party last, and you've met someone new you didn't know, you might have a bit of a chat, like sort of social chit-chat. You might ask them, you know, so where are you from? Do you have any kids? Have you got dogs? And 9 times out of 10, someone will turn around and say, so what do you do? For most of us, we've then got to explain what an actuary is versus an archer. But once you get past that, they might then ask, you know, who do you work for? It might spark a conversation. So that sort of what you do tends to really be part of who you are. And there tends to be good reasons why you've chosen to do it. And that sort of identity is pulled in with everyone. And then when you get to sort of psychosocial aspects of work as well, that's where it really becomes clear. So by that, we mean when you go to work, there's a community there. And we're social animals, we're social beings. And we enjoy meeting people, we enjoy talking to people by and large. And that's a need that doesn't have to be met by work, but for a lot of people it is. So, for example, my sister-in-law, she joined essentially a startup. And at first she was like, great, I'm going to work from home. You know, I can drop the kids off at school, I can come home, I can do a bit of work, I can make it work around everything. Within a couple of months, she hated it. And everybody she was working with hated it. And as soon as they could, they got an office that they could actually go and work together because she found it really socially isolating. So she wasn't, on a Monday morning, going into work and, you know, grabbing a cup of coffee with someone and saying, oh, what did you do at the weekend? You know, were you out, you know, at the beach, or were you walking the dogs, or did you take your kids to a party, or, you know, whatever you were doing. She didn't have that outlet. And you shouldn't undervalue that outlet. Most of your friends, be it work friends, social friends, and having that ability to talk to people is really important. So there is one major caveat around all of this. When we talk about work, we really need to talk about good work. And what do we mean by good work? So good work would be characterized as something that's safe. So you shouldn't really be going to work expecting to be not safe. It should have sufficient or at least fair pay. It should be secure. So you shouldn't be walking into work thinking, oh, am I going to have a job at the end of the day? And a really important part of it for everyone is that what they're doing, they feel that they're valued and they feel that what they're doing is trusted. And that valued, trusted, and feeling a bit in control turns out to be very important. So Dame Carol Black, that Mark mentioned earlier, talks about a time when she was in the UK and she thought she'd go out and see what bad work was. So she tried to think in her head, what were the characteristics for her of bad work? So she came up with repetitive, monotonous, and she struck on London Underground train drivers. So they're driving the same route every day. They might do it multiple times in one day. No natural light, restricted movement. And so she went and she had a chat to them and she said, you know, what could we do to make your job better? Could we put you above ground for a week? Could we allow you to do different routes? And the train drivers, or at least the one that she was talking to, went around and said, actually, I don't want to change. This is my train. This is my line. Nothing happens on my train if I don't say so. I'm responsible for the safety of my passengers. I like my route. I work with a team. I've got good occupational health. I get paid work. I don't want to work above ground. For me, this is good work. And for that person, they'd had that control, they'd had that choice, and they liked that. So something we need to always be aware of in this is not to impress our own views of what good work are, but consider for each individual customer, each individual person, what is good work for them? And that's something that we can't forget, the individualization when we're talking about good work and whether work is good for someone. So, briefly, Mark has discussed about the research that's around. So probably the main piece of the research that kicked all of this off wasn't a specific research piece. It was actually a review paper that was written by two UK professors, Gordon Waddell and Kim Burton. So they did a scientific review, essentially. They looked at all the scientific literature that was out there. They pulled it together. They collated it. They looked at different sort of statements and whether there was enough quality, quantity, and consistency of evidence to support them. They did focus primarily on three main conditions. So those were mild, moderate mental health, musculoskeletal conditions, and cardiorespiratory conditions. The reason they picked those is they cover about two-thirds of illnesses. And for most people, if you're diagnosed with one of those, it shouldn't actually be a diagnosis of sort of you're never going to work again. Most people should really have a good hope that they can get back to quite a normal life with them. Obvious exceptions in there. And the research that they did, as you've probably gathered from what we said, really did support the view that generally work is good for health and generally unemployment is bad. So we are actuaries, we are statisticians. What data is out there? I'm sure most of you have seen morbidity tables, and you know that sort of recovery rates just start really high and fall off towards the end, and by the time someone reaches sort of 5 to 10 years off work, the likelihood of them ever getting back to work is really small. It does happen, but it's very, very small. But what's really interesting about this Victorian Work Cover Authority data is that if you look at the really early durations of claims, right at the start, which we probably don't pay much attention to often, the step change when you move from 20 days to 45 days to 70 days is huge. Now, we all know different populations of claims might have slightly different percentages in there, but just the fact that if when you go 50 days on, you drop that much in your potential recovery rates. And then think about our products that we tend to sell. It's typical for us to have 60 or 90-day waiting periods where we don't even hear from someone until they've been off work for longer than this. And then if you add on notification delays on top of that, we've missed the boat for potentially helping someone to get back to work. And early intervention can make a massive difference in somebody's life. So traditionally, we would sort of look at people as going back to work and work being a potential hazard. And really what we're sort of saying here is work can be beneficial. There are potential adverse effects from working, but in most cases you should be able to strike a balance with an individual. And that's probably what we're trying to achieve here, where if you can start to bring people back to work, potentially you can start to bring them into those earlier buckets and get them back and get some improvements in their lives. Oh, sorry. I was moving on to that slide. So for evidence for recovery at work, what I forgot to say is most of what we just talked about there is actually if people are already sick or if people are already unemployed, what's the negative benefits? And if people are working, what's the positive benefits? What about people that fall sick and then we're trying to get them back to work? The literature here is kind of interesting. You get disability literature, which says everybody who is ill, who's disabled, has a right to work. And absolutely, someone who's just because someone is disabled doesn't mean they shouldn't be allowed to work. Then you go to sickness literature, medical literature, and it's all focused on medical outcomes. So there's not very much there that sort of brings the two together. So Waddell and Burton did try to see what the broad consensus was. They looked across policymakers, disability groups, unions, employers, And the general consensus was, just as for healthy people, coming back to work, there's benefits there. So you get the psychosocial benefits, you get the identity benefits, you get sort of some money coming back in. And just like both of them, there is a chance to actually bring people in and start making a difference in there.
Okay, back to me. So, how has the life insurance industry traditionally managed claims? Well, we like to say that we pay every single genuine claim that comes across our table. And that's a great way of working. But what we're forgetting there, that's really a focus on eligibility and entitlement, rather than actually being a focus on what can we do to help this person get back to the life that they had or that the life they'd like to have. So there was not much consideration given to how we can actually assist the customer other than paying them a benefit. When we did start to intervene, it was often late. And some research that was done by Swiss Re they do an annual report around return to work and interventions showed that only about 5 to 6% of income protection claims actually underwent a rehabilitation program, and not many more than that were offered it. The really compelling piece, though, around that historically, and this was back in 2014-15, the average delay to intervening with a rehabilitation program was, can you guess how many days? Any thoughts? Over 400. So over a year before someone was actually offered a rehabilitation program. So we're waiting for people to become long-term before we even went there and asked if they would or could support or be involved in a rehabilitation program. And that's broadly across, this was across the Australian environment where this research was conducted. Not great numbers. So what we did is we went to our customers and we asked them for some insights. We used a human-centred design approach and we went to them and said, and this wasn't just customers from our organisation, this was across a broad spectrum of insurers, and asked them what they were feeling when they were on claim and what could they see, what were their insights. And there were six key ones that we drew out. The first one was, I'm expecting it to be difficult. Effectively implying that by putting in a claim, my life's going to be harder because I have to jump through hoops. And what we need to look at from that perspective is how do we make it easier for our customers? The second insight, which we've spoken about before, was money doesn't really change my situation. So by giving someone an income, we don't necessarily make their life better. We might provide them with a source to provide for their family or their medical bills or whatever it might be, but we haven't actually offered them anything that makes their life better. Insight three, I feel like we're on opposite sides. Again, probably linked to number one, but it feels like they're battling because they've got to always provide proof and onus to get support. Number four was, you don't really know what I'm going through. And I think this is one where we need to have an understanding and empathy with our customers. So when they're going through a particular predicament, be that a back condition, depression, whatever it might be, that we understand what it is, we can work with them and give them the support they require. And the fifth one's an interesting one, which is, am I ready to go back to work? And there's a lot of research around this one that shows that in a lot of jurisdictions and a lot of areas, people who have been injured won't go back to work until they feel at the 100%. And we also know that medically, a lot of people won't be certified to go back to work until they're 100%. Now, the research shows that isn't necessarily demonstrated as being the best outcome. So we need to work with our customers to look at what we can offer, be it through partial work, be it through partial support, to get them back into the workplace earlier. And the final one was, again, I don't want to choose between my health and my work. And again, it's that demonstration. So if I go back to work, will my health deteriorate? So again, it comes back to what Emily was saying. We've got to provide safe work. It's not just any work. So we've used these insights and we also know that in a traditional process with claims, there's a lot of parties engaged. Now, the circles here aren't necessarily representative about who's involved more intensely on a claim, but there's certainly a lot of people that get engaged when someone's injured or ill. Occasionally in the circle, it might be the doctor, it could be the insurer, it could be someone from the employer, their return to work coordinator, or the employer themselves, it could be the case manager. But those circles so can change. So we might have a union representative who's the closest person to that customer, or it could be someone from their coordinating the rehabilitation program. These parties are engaged. Now, this is great for the person. They've got a lot of support. But sometimes the support can actually be a detriment. It actually creates illness behaviours. And also, we often get differing or conflicting views from different parties. And that can even be from the medical fraternity, where one doctor might say, you've got a spondylolisthesis of L5S1 impinging the thecal nerve sac, and the next doctor might say, you've got a disc prolapse of whatever. And the customer's then even more upset about the predicament they're in because they're getting differing views. Those things combined can make that journey much more difficult. So what I want to try and do is actually go through and share a couple of stories with you. I like telling stories. And has everyone seen these two events? Some of you would have been alive when they happened. Some of you might not have been. They both happened, believe it or not, on April the 14th. Do you know what the one on the left is? Challenger? That's Apollo 13. Do you know what the one on the right is? That would be the Titanic. So going to the story on the right, can everyone tell me the story of the Titanic? You don't have to, but do you reckon you could give me a good rendition of what happened in the Titanic? Yeah? Yeah. I'm getting some...
Boy falls in love with girl, sings at the front of the bow. Yeah.
Yep. So if you picture the Titanic, it was a big ship. It was going way too fast. It was at night. It hit an iceberg. The iceberg ripped the side of the boat out. The boat started to sink. It gathered water. The stern went under the water first. The orchestra kept playing on the deck, as we know. And eventually the boat sank and the bow went under and we never saw it again until about 15, 20 years ago when they actually were able to get that deep and see the boat again. But everyone knows that story. And I share this with people who manage claims or manage in workers' comp or in life insurance and say, the last thing that we want to do as case managers is document the Titanic sinking. Now, what I mean by that is that we all know what happened, and if we've got customers and they ring us monthly or we speak with them monthly and they just say, how are you feeling? They say, not well. We write down, customer's not feeling well. The next month they say, I'm feeling worse. Customer feeling worse. The next month they come in and say, what's happened this time? Even worse still. So we keep going through until effectively the Titanic sinks. And what we've done is documented that approach. We've paid them their benefits, but we actually haven't offered them anything much more if we're using that story. Conversely, on the left, do you all know what happened with Apollo 13? It's more of a convoluted story. But effectively, Apollo 13 was supposed to be a mission that went to the moon, and for those that believe that there was a previous landing on the moon, was going to land more people on the moon. And actually have three people, including Tom Hanks, to put feet on the moon and be the second manned mission to land on the moon. For those that don't know, on the way there, they had a fire on board. A small fire, but it upset the oxygen systems and some of their navigation pieces, and it was electrical fire. So it actually meant they couldn't go to the moon. They had to abort the mission to the moon. But what you mightn't know is that mission actually still achieved something that no other man has ever done before. It flew men the furthest away from the Earth ever, because that mission had to go around the moon and be slingshotted back. And they used a computer to do that that was less powerful than our iPhones, and they actually managed, by looking at what some options were for those people, those, call them customers, on that spaceship, what can we do to help them get back to Earth safely? We mightn't achieve our end goal, which was landing on the moon, but we can achieve other goals along the way. It might be the furthest man from the moon, and bring them back to Earth safely. So, again, if we're challenging ourselves from a case management perspective, we definitely want to follow the approach of the Apollo 13. We might have a fire, could be the condition. We need to understand what that means. What can we do to resolve it? What can we do to support the person while still providing them what we do best, which is paying genuine claims? So those two stories are pieces that we actually share with our case managers, and just to bring home some of the stories, that the storytelling that can actually help to facilitate what we're trying to achieve, which is best outcome for our customers. Another story. Have you seen this movie, Sliding Doors? Not many people probably would have, because it wasn't a great movie. But the actual storyline was actually quite interesting. So Gwyneth Paltrow, whose daughter's name's Apple, which I always love. So Gwyneth Paltrow in this movie Very early in the movie, there was a sliding door. So effectively what happened is a single circumstance in her life shifted slightly and it created two vastly different life cycles for her. One was a life of pleasure, fortune, fame and everything. The other was not so. And it was one small thing that changed that course. So again, it's worth considering that back onto what Emily was talking about early intervention, actually engaging with people who have got a disability and are in receipt of income. If we can get the sliding door happening very early, we've got a much greater chance of achieving a desirable outcome. And that could be return to work, return to life, whatever it might be. So using those stories, again, we want to make sure that we're blasting off and creating an environment that's safe for the person to facilitate and return to work, and also picking up on the nuances that might actually shift their life completely by working out where those sliding doors might be. So how can we apply those insights? We need to do an and. So yes, we need to pay people genuine claims, but we also need to provide the opportunities for them to recover and recover at work where possible. Now, we know that's not the case for all conditions and all instances. We understand that. But we need to know when it is possible and what we can do in those situations. So we can provide people with services that help them to recover. It could be rehabilitation, it could be working with their practitioners, it could be all sorts of mechanisms. It could be support services around coaching, it could be other pieces that will help them to re-engage with the community, re-engage with the workplace, or re-engage with new employment. The other thing we need to do is focus on activity and function, because it's very easy, and you might know people who are unwell. You know when you've got a cold, like Emily? And the last thing Emily wants to hear from me is saying, "You look terrible, Emily. You must be feeling terrible." But we often do that. We see people who don't look well, and we actually reinforce that. We go out and tell them that they don't look well. So we need to actually reverse that and focus on what's going well. Gee, your hair looks nice today, Emily.
Thank you.
And those glasses set your eyes off. There you go. So, again, we need to focus on positives, in this case activity and function, what the person can do, and try and de-emphasise what the diagnosis might be. Because as I said earlier, that could shift and change and not be a detriment or against the possibility for return to work. And then the final part, we need to engage better with employers, doctors and our allied health professionals. And that's where this position statement is really trying to work strongly in achieving that and trying to deliver on the benefits of work to all those audiences. But we can't do it alone. We need to do it as a community, and we need to do it urgently to make sure that there is a greater awareness about the benefits of work. Finally, you might say, well, does it work? And I've got a case study here we prepared earlier. We're not trying to say it works in every instance, but certainly we've seen very strong examples of where this can work. And in one of these cases, we had a teacher who had an income protection policy. The diagnosis was depression, but it was actually quite a nasty long-term depression with an eating disorder combined with it and lots of other pieces that actually made this situation very difficult. This person was a teacher. She stated to us, I don't think I can ever go back and teach again. So what we did was we worked with her and made one small sliding door change to that. We engaged with the employer, and the employer was actually desperate to have her back in the workplace. And they constructed a return to work plan that met her needs, met her situation, allowed her to get re-engaged gradually. And 6 months later, she was back at work. So we achieved the goal purely by shifting one small part, which was her perception that her employer didn't want her back, and us actually engaging and saying, well, actually, you know what, we've actually found out that they do. So those small things, again, they don't work every time, but the more we can do and react on those things, I think the better the outcomes we'll get with this sort of approach. So I'm going to hand back to Emily just to do a sort of a brief summary around what we've been talking about, and then we'll be open to questions. So I'll hand back to Emily.
Thanks, Mark. So if we believe in the health benefits of work, is there things that we can do as an industry? Are there things that we could do as a profession? And there's probably three big groups that we really have an ability to influence. So one are health professionals. We deal with GPs, we deal with broader allied health groups a lot, but not all these people aren't always connected with each other. They're not always connected with the employer. They don't always see the full picture of what's going on. They kind of talk directly to our customer. We do talk to all of those people, so we can help bring a broader context for individual customers and help to try and discuss what a customer can do potentially rather than just what they can't do and just changing some of that language that we use. In a broader context as policymakers, if we as an industry, we're a big industry, if we can raise awareness, awareness generally leads to potentially more money for funding research. As we said before, we're not pretending that every single illness is going to be able to go back to work quickly. But potentially we could get research to help show where what types of illnesses would benefit the most from those sorts of return to work plans. And then a really big group that we have, I know there was a session yesterday mainly talking about group life, but for those of us with group schemes in our employers, we have direct links into those employers, not dissimilar to, the workers' comp area. And we can really act as promoters to them, both from the point of view of helping people go back to work and helping them build policies that facilitate return to work and maybe facilitate part-time working for people. But also promoting those employers to make their work good and to try and promote good working practices so that people want to go back to work, and not just people who are returning to work, but their own employees are receiving those benefits. I've heard it said before that people should go to work and be healthier because they go to work rather than less healthy because they're working too many hours, for example. And what about us as employers? So financial services, if you think about a job in financial services, people tend to think about lack of sunlight, high levels of stress, long hours, potentially inflexible, particularly around about things like year end. So there's potentially quite a lot about financial services that doesn't speak to it being good work. So could we actually start to become more role models as employers and really promote health and well-being for our own employees? That could be just as powerful in many ways. It's very difficult for us to go to a group scheme and say, you should be doing all these things if we're not doing it ourselves. So in summary, there is research that supports a general belief in the health benefits of good work. And as insurers, we've got unique opportunities in quite a number of different ways to play really an active role in our customers' lives and potentially help transform them and really transform their future. So I'd like to close on a challenge to us as a profession, to us as an industry. Since I moved over to Australia, I've been to a couple of these sort of sessions, and Alan alluded to a comment this morning. Often people discuss, or the focus of sessions is on, disability income, it's unprofitable, is there really a future for it, why do we sell it? And I think if we actually look at the product and we look at what we're trying to do underneath it, there really is a need there, and there really is a role that that product can play. And if we focus on it's unprofitable, it's got no future, and we frame the questions around that, we're going to close our minds. We're never going to solve it. Because we're not open to a solution. So really the challenge is, can we change the way we think about this and say there is a need that's being fulfilled? So how can we make it work? How can we fix it?
Cool. Thank you, Emily and Mark. And we've got about 10 minutes for questions, so I think that's a fantastic positive view of how we fit into the community. But that was a very quick skim across a very complex topic. So have we got some questions or comments? Yep, great. So if you can come to the mic and give us your name and if anybody else wants to line up behind, go ahead.
Hello, okay. My name's Robert Kerr. I've only been in Australia for just under 2 years, and thankfully I've not been sick yet. But and I've come from the UK, and one of the first things they did in the UK was they stopped writing sick notes for doctors. And they've changed it to fit notes. So doctors no longer, when you're off sick, say you're off sick for a week or 2 weeks, they go now along about what you can do and what you can do with work. And to me, this seems like one of the first steps we should be doing, or we should be encouraging to be done, because it's just getting that message across about what people can do, really. So just a thought, what are your comments, really?
Yeah. Certainly, it's a great point, because Dame Carol Black, who I mentioned before from the UK, was one of the key instigators in that fit note, and actually developed that as part of her program of work, which started off as a small pilot in one one of the UK Hamlets or whatever. That's now being embraced by the whole of the UK. In Australia, it certainly has been slower to take off, but in the workers' comp jurisdiction, I know that in Victoria, New South Wales and Queensland, there's a new certification form in that space, which actually has moved away from saying what can't you do to what can you do. And there's a broad piece of work that the college is doing through the Health Principles of Good Work or Health Principles of Work position statement, which is looking at that exact piece, which is actually saying we need to focus on function and ability, not on disability. So it's a long journey. It took the UK many years to get even to the point of just being able to deliver on that. So we're very early in the piece, but certainly it's a key element, is to be able to get people to focus on ability and function. And that starts with our doctors actually embracing it as well and believing in that and actually supporting that position. So, again, early days, but, yep, definitely is somewhere we need to get to.
Great. I was worried I was going to have to talk and Andrew would have been very upset with me.
Hi, Andrew Barker. Couple of questions if there's time. The first one is just whether you'd saw any feedback from financial advisors on these sorts of concepts and what their reaction was. And the second one, which is completely unrelated, when you're going through the product design process, some great concepts here, but from a pricing perspective, you're into a realm which feels relatively new. So just interested as to how you're going through that pricing process, if there's statistics out there or if it's a bit of a control cycle where you make an assumption and then you learn over time as you implement.
Do you want to take financial?
I'll do the financial advice.
You want to do pricing?
I could give pricing a crack, but maybe I shouldn't. I'm not sure how many physios out there do much in pricing. Not many? No, I could be a first. Certainly from a financial advice, yes, we did go... Sorry, Andrew, I didn't realise you moved. We certainly did go to our advisors and have discussions with them around what we're trying to deliver. And with that is our key philosophy around helping people get back to their best life. And part of that was about early intervention, return to work. And broadly, it's hard to argue with that. Like, it's sort of one of those things that just makes sense. So the advisors definitely can see that activity and those pieces or those beliefs make complete sense. Delivering it and actually supporting that might be a second wave that we need to get to. But certainly... broadly speaking, when we went to our advisors, they were all unanimous in saying that, yep, that makes sense. Early intervention makes sense. Encouraging return to work, focusing on ability all makes sense. We're still working through the next piece, which is actually applying it and making them aware of when it happens to one of their customers what that looks like. Pricing, but...
I can't talk explicitly to pricing. I'm not part of the pricing team, but I know they have been quite heavily engaged with what's going on. I see more on the valuation side, so the sort of some of the similar concepts coming through. And certainly from an assumption setting point of view, as an actuary, that sort of some of that falls under my team. And it does present challenges. Traditionally, as actuaries, we'll look at what's happening in the past and say, great, we can project that forward to the future. In this sort of world where we're potentially looking at fundamentally changing some of how we act, we could change both our own behaviour, but potentially both customer behaviour, for example. So that sort of backward-looking view no longer becomes as useful. And you do start to have to try and really link in with the business and really actually probably as an actuary get far more involved in what's happening than traditionally we might have done. We might have sat in a back office, looked at our data, been into our SQL databases and gone, yeah, that's it. But now certainly I'm far more engaged with what's happening with the claims team. I'm talking to them. I'm seeing what's happening. And you do have to build those networks and build those relationships and understand a bit more about what's going on and just talk a bit more and try to pull that in. So your assumption papers, for example, become far less data-driven and you have to be honest about the fact that there's uncertainty. You can't start... You have to really bring that to the fore.
Mark wants to comment on pricing.
Yeah. A lot of things we're talking about are free. Got to remember that. So having a conversation with a customer and talking about what we can do is free. We don't have to, that doesn't come into pricing. It's just purely having a conversation. So even if just the starting point is actually picking up the phone, talking to customers, engaging with them about what they can do and how they could do it, is something we can do without having to look at even any price. And for me, it's, you know, that's a very, very cheap insurance if we can actually start to encourage that sort of behaviour and that sort of those sorts of things to support someone back to doing what they were doing.
It's probably time for one more question. Somebody else is racing to the microphone. Great.
Rylan Cummings. The sort of things that you've mentioned, I guess, are about, you know, finding, getting employers on side, finding jobs with limited duties, getting people to gradually back to work. A lot of the disability income people, I guess, are self-employed. So do you feel that you have a much more limited toolkit for those people?
It certainly increases the complexity, there's no doubt about that. But it shouldn't be something where we say, oh, this person's self-employed, we just won't try. Because in many instances, it's us getting a better understanding of what they were doing and how they were doing it and actually giving them support, not directly by myself or Emily, whoever it might be, but providing them with the services that might be able to offer some support in that situation. So I think the short answer is let's not just assume that because someone's self-employed that they've got no opportunities, even if their company that they were self-employed in no longer exists, because we have many people in that situation. But we should be able to look at other options that might meet their capability, their capacity, their ability to actually drive that. So it shouldn't be it's an and, I think, in that context.
Okay, well, look, I have to tell you that I am actually married to a physio, so I'm an actuary married to a physio. I think it's been a great pairing for me, and I think the pairing today has been fantastic. I think particular thanks to Mark to coming to talk to a bunch of actuaries, and it's great to see our profession working with other people from other professions and actually trying to help our customers get better outcomes. So please join me in thanking the two of them. Please fill out your feedback online.